You are about to experience another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com. Bringing Mashiach closer, one click at a time.
Tikkun Shmuz is very dear to me in the sense that it is the close to the yahrzeit of the Rosh Hashiva. And the title of the Shmuz, interestingly enough, is My Rebbe, the Rosh Hashiva Zatzal. And I'll explain soon why I titled it specifically that. A big part of this, hopefully, will be a personal recollection more than a communal, global recollection. But let's begin with the Chazal. Pasuk in Chumash says, Eilu Pekudei HaMishkan, these are the reckonings, these are the countings of the Mishkan, Mishkan HaEdus, the Mishkan that was the testimony that was commanded Api Moshe. Now this pasuk is defining for us something very interesting, and that is that after the Mishkan was established, after the various kelim were made, were fashioned, were formed, and the Mishkan was effectively fully made, Moshe Rabbeinu counts the various parts of them. The pasuk here says these are the reckonings, and the psukim are going to go on to explain to us what each nedava, which each donation was used for. But what's unusual about the pasuk is it says Mishkan HaEdus. The Mishkan is a testimony. But the pasuk doesn't tell us what the Mishkan is a testimony to. The Daz Zakenim explains to us, Shaya Edus LaMoshe, the Mishkan was actually a testimony to Moshe, Ki B'Shah Shechad Shu Sheganav Shekalim Melechas HaMishkan, because when they suspected Moshe of stealing Shekalim, of stealing the silver coins from the Mishkan, Amala Moshe said to them, Rosani Shaya Mishkan Edus, I want the Mishkan itself to be a testimony. The Chazru Umanu, they went back and recounted, Umatsu Shehushmu Bivaim LaMudim, they found that those shkolim that they suspected Moshe of stealing were actually used in the little sort of loops that held up the amudim, that held up the metal piece that supported the actual columns that supported part of the Mishkan. The Balei Tosfos goes a little bit further and explains to us what were they choshed. Apparently there were 16 shkolim, 16 silver coins that were missing. They suspected Moshe of them. Moshe demanded the reckoning. Moshe said, I want there to be an accounting, because he wanted to prove the fact that he didn't steal these various silver coins. And when they went and counted, they found, in fact, he didn't steal them. Everything was accounted for. Everything was properly used. Now, if you've been to the Shmuz more than once, you'll already understand what the question is. The question on this Daz Zakenim is, how is it possible? How is it imaginable that anyone would suspect Moshe Rabbeinu of stealing money from the Mishkan? It would be very difficult to describe the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Rambam says he was the Av, the Chochma, Benavua, Betorah. He was the greatest human being who ever lived. The Klal Yisrael were with him when he brought the 10 Makkas. The Klal Yisrael were with him when he split the Yam. The Klal Yisrael saw him go up to Shemayim, live for 40 days and 40 nights without food, and when he came down, his face shone like the sun. He wore the masveh. Why? Because he had to separate between himself and the rest of the people, because his countenance was so bright. It was so difficult to look at. He had to put some sort of veil in front of him so he wouldn't blind people looking at him. The man was akin to a Malach Elokim. And apparently, they suspected that he stole money. But listen to how much money. Not a king's ransom. Not that he stole billions of dollars in gold bullion. He stole 16 shkolim, 16 silver coins. Rather strange. But what makes it even more strange is that they were living in the Midbar. There was no economy. You didn't buy. You didn't trade. What did you do with your money in the Midbar? They were all very, very wealthy because they despoiled Mitzrayim. We were left Berechush Gadol. In the Midbar itself, where they were, there was nothing in terms of commerce. So there was no reason for him to have stolen. But even more than anything, let's understand this single point. When a man is makdish money, when a man gives truma, when a man makes a nedava to the Mishkan, it automatically becomes kadosh, it's consecrated, it's holy. Even gangsters don't steal from the church plate, because that's lowly. They suspected the greatest man alive of stealing petty cash from the plate that went around being collected for the holiest item ever on the face of the planet. it seems very difficult to understand how, in fact, they were choshed Moshe, and he actually had to call a reckoning. I want to prove to you I didn't steal. Let's do an accounting. And the question is, what was the Havamina? What did they suspect Moshe? How is it possible to suspect him of stealing? And to answer this question, I'd like to give you a little perspective. And let's start with a story. The story is told that the Chofetz Chaim was once in his house. There's a knock on the door. A poor man comes to collect food. The Chofetz Chaim welcomes him in and says, sit down, prepares a meal for him, stands over him like a waiter, gives him everything he needs. After the meal is all done, the man gets up to leave. And as the man is exiting, the Chofetz Chaim notices that the man left with the Chofetz Chaim's silverware. The man walks into the street and starts running. And the Chofetz Chaim starts running after him. Stop, stop! Don't forget it's fleishik. The knife is fleishik. Okay, now that is a very touching story to see other-centeredness, to see a person so dedicated to someone else. He's not concerned about his own property. He's not concerned about his knife. He's concerned that the other person shouldn't eat treif. Very impressive, but here's an observation. The man stole a knife from the Chofetz Chaim. The Meshuggah? The Chofetz Chaim, the holy Posek Hador, the man whose name goes from one end of the earth to the other, the man who lives on history, steal a knife from the Chofetz Chaim? You know what the answer is? For almost the entire lifetime of the Chofetz Chaim wasn't the Chofetz Chaim. He was Yisrael Meir HaKohen, a simple balabas who almost no one knew who he was. And even when the Chofetz Chaim began, his reputation began spreading, and certain elite people knew him, certain people machshav him, to the average person, oh, he's a great rabbi, a good person, but he's like you and me, all right, he learns better than you and I, he may know more than you and I, but he's a regular person. And I dare say one of the trappings of living amongst great people is that you rarely ever appreciate their greatness. Even those who appreciated the greatness of Chofetz Chaim never fully appreciated until he left this earth, and the vast majority of people never really did. I'll share with you one more story that I find very telling. Rav Aaron Cutler, in his yeshiva, used to get shlishi every Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos. That was the minhag in yeshiva. He was the yeshiva. He always got shlishi. One day, he gets called up for shlishi, and he passes a bacher, a chashav bacher in yeshiva. And as Rav Aaron passes by, this bacher says something akin to, huh, what kind of business? Every Monday and Thursday, Rav Aaron gets shlishi. Without missing a beat, Rav Aaron said, nu, you'll be gabbai, and it'll be different. But I want you to hear what I'm saying. The chutzpah, the audacity of Aaron Cutler, Gadol HaDor, the pioneer of Torah in America, the founder of Lakewood Yeshiva and so much more, and you have the audacity to say such a line? But the answer is, when you're in Rav Aaron Yeshiva, he's a Rosh Yeshiva, you know, it's not right, but, you know, he's not like a Gadol HaDor, he's not like a huge giant, he's just a regular person, all right, bigger than me, knows more than me, but it's not like the Gedolim of yesteryear, he's not like the Chofetz Chaim, he's not like the Chassam Sofer, he's just, you know, the Talmud Chacham in our day. And this is a very human failing. Almost invariably, when you're living amongst greatness, it's very hard to perceive it, very hard to recognize it. There's an expression that I think has a lot of weight to it, acharei mos kedoshim, after they die, they become holy. It's only after a person leaves this earth, only after they're in a different strata altogether, that you begin to appreciate who they were. And my friends, I believe that's exactly pshat Moshe Rabbeinu. We look back and can't envision or imagine how is it possible that anyone suspected that person of thievery. But the answer is, listen, he's a human being like you and me. All right, granted, he went up for 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, granted, he's a Makabal Kol HaTorah. But, you know, he has Nagias just like you and I, and he's human just like you and I, and who's to say he didn't steal? We today would never, ever think such a thing because we understand who Moshe Rabbeinu was. But when you're living in the times, and when you see him on a daily basis, it's very, very hard to recognize his real greatness. It's very difficult to understand that he's in a totally different category. And typically, when you live amongst Gedolim, you never realize it, you never recognize it. It's only in hindsight, it's only long after the fact, that people recognize who they were. I believe it's exactly pshat in Moshe Rabbeinu. They suspected him of stealing 16 shkalim because there was money missing. Granted, it was money from the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan. Granted, it wasn't that much money, but who's to say he didn't take it? And he had to actually just do a reckoning. Let's count. Let's do a cheshbon. I'll prove it to you. Because no matter who you are, no matter how great, people don't appreciate you. That's pshat in the Chofetz Chaim, and that's pshat in Rav Aaron. On the 10th day of Nisan, a little bit more than a year ago, the world lost a very great person. The Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal was Nifter. And it's very difficult to try to picture the accomplishments of this man. On a very superficial level, you could look at the establishments. If you look at the grade schools, the high schools, Bati Midrashim, Kolels, Kiruv centers, shuls, outreach centers, you'll count almost 100 full, powerful institutions that are founded or affiliated directly with the yeshiva. If you count the amount of rabbonim that the Rosh Yeshiva produced, you count the amount of Rosh Yeshivas that the Rosh Yeshiva produced, the amount of mechanchim, the amount of teachers, the amount of solid B'nai Torah, it's an astounding number. And if you go across the country, you look at places like Milwaukee, Rochester, Los Angeles, Five Towns, Miami, Cherry Hill, Manalapan, Las Vegas, Dallas, Boston, you have branches of the yeshiva, Eretz Yisrael, an entire dynasty and empire. The man literally forged an empire of Torah, changed the face of Torah in America, and I dare say was the greatest Marbitz Torah of his generation. And the question really is, who was the man and what allowed him to accomplish what he did? And before I even enter into this sort of trying to paint a picture, I'd like to share with you something that Rabbi Harris said at the Levaya of the Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Harris said that if you approach a mountain, it's vast, it's high, it's wide, you'll see it from one vantage point, and someone standing on a different end will see a totally different image. Someone else standing at a different perspective will see something different. It's very difficult when you're trying to describe a mountain to take it all in one panoramic view, and you really can't. You describe it as you see it from your vantage point, from your angle, a little bit of the mountain, surely not much. And I think when discussing a gadol, it is very important to remember that any attempt is but a description of the little bit that a person sees. The reason why I named this particular shmooze the Rosh Yeshiva, my Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva, is because this is my perspective. This is not the art scroll biography. This is not the ultimate rendition of the life of the Rosh Yeshiva. This is my perspective as a Talmud of the Rosh Yeshiva that I would like to share because he was my Rebbe and what I gained from him. And again, the greatest danger of any such attempt to describe is that it's very personal. It's nowhere near a description of the full totality of the person, but it will be, Mitzvah Shem, an attempt to paint a certain picture. Let me begin with one key observation. World War II was a change in the face of Torah. Before that war, there were many European yeshivas, great yeshivas, and each one was vastly different one from the other. Telz was markedly different than Slobodka. Slobodka was seriously, significantly different than was Novardik. Radin had his own flavor. Each yeshiva had its own derech in learning. Each yeshiva had its own derech in Musar. Each yeshiva had its own derech in Chaim. Different approaches. In America today, that's largely not the scene. If you go across from one yeshiva to the other, they're all the same. By and large, with few exceptions. In fact, in Yeshiva Shesprach, it's one yeshiva. You learn a year here, a year there, and you're not, because it's all one yeshiva. Now, that's a very interesting change in the reality that was. There used to be very distinct derechs. Apparently, many people felt that the American scene can't take that type of rugged individualism, can't take that separate identity. It's one melting pot, and it's, I don't want to say dummied down, but it's definitely changed. One of the great accomplishments of the Rosh Yeshiva is that he took the Slobodka Derech. He took the Derech that his father taught him and he molded it to the American scene. It is not identical to Slobodka. If you look at Chofetz Chaim today, it is vastly different than what Slobodka, but it's the application of that Derech. And it's a true genius to be able to take the Derech, remain pure to it, but mold it, apply it, update it to today's times. And that's what the Rosh Yeshiva did. If you look at a Chofetz Chaim guy, he speaks very, very differently than most of the yeshiva guys. He learns differently. His Mahalach HaChaim is very different. Certainly when you speak to him in learning, when you speak to him in Musar, when you speak to him about his general approach, you see there's a commonality. There's a certain language they all speak. There's a certain common tongue. And it's very unique and very distinct. One of the greatest accomplishments that the Rosh Yeshiva did was continue the Derech of Slobodka, update it, mold it, and bring it to the American shores, molding Bnei Torah in America after the fashion that his father taught him. I'd like to spend a minute sort of getting an appreciation of how he accomplished what he did. And to do that, I'd like to spend just a moment or two on background. The Rosh Yeshiva's father, Rav David Leibowitz, was a grand-nephew of the Chofetz Chaim. As a young boy, the Chofetz Chaim came to his Rav David's father's house. The Chofetz Chaim saw this young Rav David and was amazed by his brilliance. He said to his father, his nephew, David's father, "I want you to send him to Radom, let him learn by me." And in fact, at a tender young age, Rav David went to the Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva in Radom, learned by him. The Rosh Yeshiva there was Rav Naftali Trupp. Rav Naftali Trupp said about Rav David when he was 19 years old, "He's a finished Lamdan. Anything that I could have taught him, I've taught him, he's finished." Not long thereafter, the Chofetz Chaim said to Rav David, "You've learned how to learn, now it's time for you to learn how to be a Baal Musar," and he sent him to the Alt of Slobodka. For the rest of his life, Rav David held the Alt of Slobodka to be his Rebbe, that was his Derech HaChaim, that was his Derech in Musar, and that was his main Rebbe. After a few different events, Rav David joined the Kovna Kollel. Part of the process of being a member of this elite kollel, by the way, the who's who in America, Rosh Yeshiva, who's who in Eretz Yisrael Yeshiva, were the Kovna Kollel, 14 Yad Chazaka. Part of the curriculum was the fact that when you were done, you went to America to raise funds for the kollel. In 1926, Rav David came to America to raise funds for the kollel. At that time, Yeshiva Torah V'Das had made the decision to open a Beis Medrash. Up until that point, they had a high school. They never had a Beis Medrash before. They made the decision to open a Beis Medrash, and they were looking for a Rosh Yeshiva. There were very, very few qualified people on the American shores. And they asked the Dvar Avram, a tremendous Talmid Chacham, who was the right man? David Leibowitz, he's here, grab him. They made an offer to Rav David. Rav David consulted with his uncle, and his uncle said to him, "You know how to learn, you should be a Marbitz Torah," and he was given the directive to remain on these shores. At that point, his wife was not here, and at that point, his young son was not here either. He remained here for 3 years, and his wife and son eventually made it over. He became a Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva Torah V'Das. He was there for 7 years. During those 7 years, he was very, very influential, very effective, but there was a major machlokas between he and the administration of the yeshiva. He was bringing by Slobodka. He was trying to mold greatness. He saw the potential in the American Bachar and said, "There's no reason why an American Bachar has to be anything less than his European counterpart," and he was trying to create great leaders of the Jewish nation. The administration of the yeshiva of Torah V'Das had a different approach. They felt what America needed then were frum balabatim. We need many, many frum balabatim. We can't afford the luxury of creating a few elite leaders. And because of a very strong difference in opinion, Rav David basically left the yeshiva and founded his own yeshiva in 1933. A bit of history, 1933 was the Depression era. Not a good time to start a yeshiva. In a time when on the American shores, Torah was looked at as, I mean, you learn until you're 13, 14, but the idea of learning in a Beis Medrash after you're 18 years old, who does that? And he began a very, very difficult path, and very, very poor, and he suffered greatly during those years. 26 out of the 28 Bochrim in Torah Vedas Beis Medrash followed him to his new yeshiva, but needless to say, he had no building, no funds, no capital behind him, and it was a very, very difficult building time period. His best Talmud, his most loyal Talmud, was his son. His son remained at his side, and his son began growing and learning. His son was part of Rav David's Blatchir. At a certain age, Rav David asked his son, Rav Shiva now, to begin giving shir. But Rav Shiva was very sickly. At the age of 22, the Rav Shiva was so sick that he really couldn't learn for 2 years. And the deal was, when he began getting better, Rav David again asked him to join the Anhala of the yeshiva. And at that point, the Rav Shiva said as follows: I'll agree to join the yeshiva if I can learn for 5 more years. That was in fact the agreement, that he was basically, the Rav Shiva was basically to be learning, also giving shir, but basically learning for the next 5 years. And that plan was cut short because on Pearl Harbor Day, on December 7th, 1941, Rav David was nifter. He passed away at the age of 52, and he left his young son, then Alter Henoch Shiva, to be the leader of his yeshiva. Now keep in mind, the Rav Shiva then was single, young man, younger than many of the students currently at that point in the yeshiva. And I remember the Rav Shiva describing to us what it was like at the levaya of his father. There were other Talmidei Chachamim in America at the time, and the Rav Shiva said they looked at him like wolves. They were hungering for this position. Rav Nota Greenblatt said that he heard the Rav Shiva speak at the levaya, and you could see a presence that no one had seen before. You could see him stand up, and because he had such a love for his father, his desire was to continue the legacy of his father, to keep his father alive. He went to Rav Aaron to ask the question, am I fit? Am I roy to be a Rosh Yeshiva? Rav Aaron knew of him as an Eloi. Rav Aaron asked him to present something, talked in learning. Rav Aaron said, you are fit. You can be a Rosh Yeshiva. And at the age of 24 years old, without a beard, beardless, single, penniless, the Rosh Yeshiva took over the mantle of leadership of that yeshiva. For 64 years, he was a Rosh Yeshiva. Maybe one of the longest standing Rosh Yeshivas, certainly in our time, in a very, very long time. The first 18 years of his career as Rosh Yeshiva were miserable. Poverty. He began in 1941, this was World War II era, there were no monies for anything. Torah certainly again was not chashuv, and he didn't have any clout to go raise funds. A young man, single, who claims to be a Rosh Yeshiva, no one knows him. The first 18 years were very, very difficult, to the extent that after those 18 years, the Rosh Yeshiva basically was considering quitting. He always had an aspiration to go to Eretz Yisrael and be a posek. I remember hearing very vividly the Rosh Yeshiva would describe, I could be a posek, paskin halacha, learn halacha, I always wanted that. And I remember him telling us clearly there was one reason why I didn't. I heard my father's voice, you have to be a malamed, you could teach, you could be a marbit Torah, you have to teach. And the Rosh Yeshiva continued. It's very hard to imagine what it was like in those days with a few people sitting around the table, but I could describe to you what Blatchir was like in my day. You see, the Rosh Yeshiva had a very, very different approach to learning and to teaching than most people do. Blatchir basically consisted of the Rosh Yeshiva would come in, take off his jacket, roll up his sleeves and say, all right guys, let's go to work. And from that moment on, there was a liveness. There was an electricity to him. There was a vibrancy to the event. If you came to Blatchir when I was in Shir, the only thing that comes close to describing it is a press conference. The amount of energy, the asking, the how do you know, the back and forth, the questioning. As a matter of fact, when I was in Shir, there was a Yom Aleph and a Yom Beis. You see, the Rosh Yeshiva's entire approach was not to give shir. The Rosh Yeshiva's approach was to teach you how to learn. And the entire approach was to beckon from the Talmidim questions and to understand how they think, to train them in thinking. And there was a tremendous amount of back and forth, give and take. Every sugya was developed together with the Talmidim, and it was an extraordinarily interactive event. The Rosh Yeshiva rarely spoke for more than 3 or 4 minutes, and there would be a question and answer back and forth, and the shiur developed in a very give and take, very interactive manner. The Rosh Yeshiva used to describe it as a mechamta shel Torah. Initially, it would just begin by reading, asking back and forth, someone express an opinion, something would get heated back and forth and forth back, and before you know it, voices got raised, energy levels got more intense, and it was a melchama, a war of Torah going on. And you would see the Rosh Yeshiva's face, if you'd see the energy of the guys. By the time I was in the Rosh Yeshiva's blotch here, the Rosh Yeshiva was already in his mid-60s. He was a sickly man. He had suffered tremendously, but there was an energy of vibrance in that room that was difficult to describe. Just to give you an illustration of it, after one fever-pitched battle back and forth with the guys, Rabbi Chopper described to us what happened. Rabbi Chopper would walk the Rosh Yeshiva out afterwards, and after one such session, Rabbi Chopper walked the Rosh Yeshiva. As the Rosh Yeshiva got out of the blotchier room, the Rosh Yeshiva just fell to the wall. And the only way he continued walking to his office was by supporting himself along the wall. When he got into his office, he said to Rabbi Chopper, "Please, Mordechai, bring me the chair." The chair, which was on the other side of the room, was too much of a difficult task for him to walk to. He asked Rabbi Chopper to bring the chair to him because he was so wiped out, so exhausted. The amelus in Torah, the energized work, the total dedication to understanding pshat was unbelievable. Sheer focused on one thing, emes. What's pshat? What is Tosa saying? What does he mean? How do you know? How do you know it's not the other way? How do you know the Mashal didn't mean this? And there was such a drive for emes, for truth, for pshat. It made a very, very powerful impression, and it made a tremendous roshim on anyone there. It was an experience that I don't think can be matched. On a typical day, the Rosh Yeshiva described later on that when he would leave, his shirt was drenched. And the result was a tremendous understanding and a tremendous clarity of thought. I want to again give it one little piece of background. The Rosh Yeshiva was not well. He had various disorders. He had constantly had gastrointestinal issues. He had migraine headaches on a regular basis. He had neuromuscular disorders. On a regular basis, he was sickly. But in the shiur, you never knew it. You never realized it. It was only afterwards when the Rebbetzin would say, "Enough." I can't tell you how unpopular I was in those days. The Rebbetzin considered me public enemy number one. Because the Rebbetzin's job was to protect the Rosh Yeshiva's health, and none of us realized that the Rosh Yeshiva was sickly, and none of us realized that the Rosh Yeshiva was pushing to his utter limits of physical strength. And so we would ask, we would follow the Rosh Yeshiva out, we would ask again, and we'd meet the Rosh Yeshiva early in the morning, meet the Rosh Yeshiva when he was driving, whenever we could, and the Rebbetzin realized that it was a real sakana to his health, because the Rosh Yeshiva was literally pushing himself beyond limits. But again, this was the mahalach that the Rosh Yeshiva gave over. An unbelievable sense of understanding pshat, emes, and when you heard the finished product, the clarity, the understanding, any sugya that we learned in blotchir, it was like you pummeled down to the depth of the shir. We would spend at least 1 week before the shir learning everything. The best guys in the blotchir my day would go through everything written on the sugya. Every rishon, every achron, every Rosh Hashiva. It was cover to cover by the time blotchir started. And there was no question that guys were solid, and guys were good, they had a very good grip. But when the shir began, everything took on a whole different sense of depth, of clarity. It was like a brilliant spotlight being shown on the sugya as you dug in deeper and more deeply and more deeply. And the shiva uncovered depths that were unparalleled. You never would have seen them otherwise. You can't begin to imagine the depth and all that, and you see it afterwards in the very words of Tosas, and you say to yourself, "I can't imagine how that could have been there," but it's there. And Rosh Yeshiva was Magala Amukos, brought it up to the surface, but more than anything, brought the Talmidim with them along the path. It wasn't erudition, it wasn't statements thrown out, it was bringing the Talmidim along with. And one of the most astounding things, if you've ever taught, and I've tried this for years and he never succeeded, the Rosh Yeshiva would have a person ask the question. Typically, if you're the teacher, you listen to the question and you try to answer the question. But that's not what the Rosh Yeshiva would do. And the Rishiva would ask the fellow, could you say that again, please? The Rishiva didn't want to hear the question the fellow was asking. And the Rishiva wanted to hear what was the underlying mistake that brought him to that position that made him make that error that caused that question. And invariably, when the person would ask this question, the Rishiva would be 3 or 4 steps earlier, be talking over here, and you'd be like, how does that talk to that? And then the guy would, oh, now I get it. And only when you would retrace the steps would you recognize what the Rishiva was doing. The Rishiva was building Talmidim. He was making Talmidim by getting into their mindset, getting into their way of thinking, shaping their understanding, because he was creating people in learning. His goal was to create Gedolim, to create Talmidei Chachamim. I say the Shmuz. The Rishiva didn't say the Shmuz. I'll explain to you the difference. When I talk about davening, if I talk about emunah, if I talk about things, so it's very clear, and I assume it's obvious, that I'm working on those things as everyone else. Maybe I spend a little more time thinking about it, so I'll present the thought, but I'm certainly never presenting the position that I'm actually holding there. I'm working on it. And the Rishiva lived the Shmuz. You see, when the Rishiva would say a Musa Shmuz, you knew he was that and that was him. It's very difficult for me to give over to you the change in the way a Chazal would appear when the Rishiva would put it out there. You walked with Avram Avinu. He described Avram Avinu's life, but not just his life, his inner thoughts and what his positions were. What was his personal Nagia? What was the holy Nagia? And you delved into the psyche of Avram Avinu. You delved into the depth of Moshe Rabbeinu's personality, and you understood how great he was. You got an eye glimpse at how stellar the human being was, how much above us he was, but you also saw the chink in the armor, and you got to appreciate what was in the Nesoyim for Moshe Rabbeinu. Chazal came to life. These people came to life, and when you knew the Rishiva on a personal basis, you also knew that he lived those very words. He was the Shmuz. He didn't say it. It's very difficult to give over the extraordinary care that the Rishiva had when it came to other human beings' covered and other human beings' feelings. The Rishiva never, ever criticized. Never. We used to ask on a regular basis, why doesn't the Rishiva give Musar? Why doesn't the Rishiva tell us when we do things wrong? The Rishiva would say, you guys, a tissue paper, you'll melt, you'll fall apart, you can't. And he would never criticize. I considered myself very, very fortunate. The Rishiva one time gave me a chelek, and he was right. Ooh, it hurt. It cut. I didn't ask a second time. And the Rishiva was very, very guarded in what he said, how he said, in an extraordinary sense of treating the average person with covered. If I would describe what it was like on Groton Street, if I would describe to you what it was like when the Rishiva walked into the Italian barbershop in Forest Hills, every person sitting there, the Rishiva would greet. Hi. These were regular people. They were not Jewish, certainly not the elite of the Western civilization. How are you? How are you? He wouldn't sit down until he greeted every person there. An OT told me that when he would walk into the waiting room, every person in the waiting room, this OT understood who the Rishiva is. It would usher him right in. He didn't want the Rishiva to have to wait. The Rishiva would say, please, wait a minute, I can't. To say, to greet people. He would greet everyone there in the waiting room, only then would he go in. There was such a care for the dignity, the honor of human being. You saw Slobodka Musar. You see, Slobodka Musar held of the godless Adam, the greatness of the human. Normally, what you work on is understanding your greatness, understanding your potential, understanding what you could reach. When you would be around the Rishiva, you would see the potential of every person around him, because the cover that he treated other people with, the respect, was unimaginable. One of the greatest things Rishiva taught us was the way to rate another person. And I learned from the Rishiva that you rate Gedolim by how humble they are. And I don't know of a man, there was no human being I ever knew who was more humble than the Rishiva. And it's very hard to describe how the Rishiva could get away with these lines and actually fool him. And you see, any time I was around the Rishiva, I felt chashuv. I felt that my opinion was valuable. I felt important. You see, when you're around an arrogant man, he's boastful, he brags, he's big, you feel very little. When you're in the presence of a humble man, it's the exact opposite. Whenever I was in the proximity of the Rosh Yeshiva, I felt smart, talented, capable, and it was a wonderful feeling. And what I quickly discovered is it was not my personal feeling. Anyone who met the Rosh Yeshiva felt special, felt dignified, because they were treated with an honor that's hard to imagine. Dr. Paul Bermansky, who was the Rosh Yeshiva's internist, told me a very interesting thing. The Rosh Yeshiva would come to his office on a regular basis, and the nurses, the practice management people, acted differently. They acted in a way that was very out of character. They acted very dignified. Normally they might have used certain languages. They wouldn't use that language. But I said to Dr. Bermansky, okay, fine. So you prepped them that this great rabbi is coming, so they were careful. He said, no. When the Rosh Yeshiva was in the hospital, the nurses spoke differently. They acted differently, and they didn't know who he was. They knew he was a rabbi, but no one told him. You could feel it on the floor. It was palpable. People commented how nice everybody is today, how polite people are. Shimon Yishal used to tell Dr. Bermansky, your staff, they're all so polite. Dr. Bermansky tried to explain to him, it's only because Rosh Yeshiva is here, because normally they're not so polite. There was a marked change in people's behavior because this person entered. Not this big, mighty, important person. This very humble, simple person who understood the greatness of another human being and gave off that sense that you are chashuv. That was a rather unique capacity that I haven't seen any other human being begin to touch. The Rosh Yeshiva also had a rather unique relationship with his Talmidim. Rabbi Aryeh Rodin, Rav in Dallas, now told me a very interesting story. He took the Rosh Yeshiva once on Erev Shabbos to the barber. And obviously this is his Rebbe, so there's no cover that he possibly could do that's too great for him. He brings the Rosh Yeshiva in, sits him down, takes the Rosh Yeshiva's coat, hangs it up, stands by the Rosh Yeshiva, anything you can need. The barber, an Italian fella, said to him, is this your father? Rabbi Rodin says, no. The Rosh Yeshiva says, he's my son, though. And that defined the Rosh Yeshiva's relationship to his Talmidim. They were his sons. Ironically, and I don't know if the word ironic is correct, but the Rosh Yeshiva and Rebbetzin didn't have any biological children. They had many, many students who were children. Throughout the years, guys always lived in the basement, and they were close. I can't even describe the word close. They were literally sons, literally children of the Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Yoel Edelman, who is the Bochei now in the yeshiva, when you take smicha, he gives the test. When he was in his 50s and his 60s, he would go every Erev Shabbos to visit the Rosh Yeshiva. How could I not go to visit my Rebbe? He would get in his car and travel because I have to visit my Rebbe every Erev Shabbos. And if you talk to hundreds of Talmidim, they all regarded the Rosh Yeshiva as their Rebbe, as their father, as their teacher, a very close, close, dear person. The Rosh Yeshiva was never machban on his cover. That was a shita that the Rosh Yeshiva held. As a matter of fact, sometimes Chafetz Chaim Rebbeim get into trouble because they act too chummy with the guys. The reason they act that way is because that's how the Rosh Yeshiva acted in Blachir. That's how the Rosh Yeshiva acted with the guys, like he was one of the guys. It was such a youthfulness and such a young. I remember the Rosh Yeshiva constantly complaining, look at his beard, it's white. I'm an old man. The Rosh Yeshiva had such a youthfulness to him, such an energy, such an alive spirit. And he bonded with the Chevra, he bonded with his Talmidim. It was certainly a surprise to me, and I believe to many others, when we found out that the Rosh Yeshiva was going to be buried in Mount Hebron here in Queens Cemetery. Because it was known that for more than 30 years ago, the Rosh Yeshiva bought a plot in Har HaZesim next to his father-in-law. His father-in-law was a Rav Avram Trupp, famed Rosh Yeshiva. And for many years, the Rosh Yeshiva went through a lot of difficulty to make sure that he had a plot in Har HaZesim. And it was only very recently that the Rosh Yeshiva changed his mind. And the rationale of why he changed his mind is as telling as anything else. He said as follows, it's easier for the Talmidim to come visit here. I want to be buried here. Most of the Talmidim live in America. He felt it's easier. He wanted to have a kesher, even when he's no longer here. And the Talmidim will come, they'll get chizuk. That was the reason why he changed his place where he'd be buried. Rosh Yeshiva held of no chumras. He used to say to us on a regular basis, "Halavai you keep Shulchan Aruch. Halavai you keep what it says in the Mishbura. No externals, no chitzonius, no chumras. Keep the halacha." But the truth is, Rosh Yeshiva held many chumras himself. Most people weren't aware of them, but if you were close with the Rosh Yeshiva, you knew some of them. Luckily, I found out one of the Rosh Yeshiva's chumras before it was enacted. I had learned for 2 years in Rochester, first under Rabbi Harris and then Rabbi Davidowitz, before I came to Rosh Yeshiva's Blatchir. And Rabbi Davidowitz cautioned me before I came to Rosh Yeshiva's Blatchir, you have to know the Rosh Yeshiva has certain anhagas, and he apprised me of them. Luckily for me. Because one time I called up the Rosh Yeshiva with a certain question. Rebbetzin put him on the phone. I asked him the question. And then out of respect for the Rosh Yeshiva, I didn't dare end the conversation. I just sort of stopped. And there was dead silence. And then I... And it went on and on and on until Baruch Hashem, I remembered. And I said, "Oh, thank you, Rebbe." And I hung up. You see, what Rabbi Davidowitz had explained to me is one of the chumras Rosh Yeshiva held was as follows. If you come to my house and visit, it'd be very rude for me to kick you out, to tell you to leave. I wait for you to leave. Rosh Yeshiva held, when you call him up, you've sort of come in. He felt it rude for him to end the conversation, and he waited for you to end the conversation, and that was a hopefully over. He waited and waited and waited and waited, and Baruch Hashem, I knew that, remembered at the last moment, otherwise maybe we'd still be there today. I don't know. But that was a chumrah. The chumras in other people's regards, the chumrah in other people's feelings, the chumras, you could feel it in the yeshiva. There were certain guys in the yeshiva who were known as liars. They were called liars. Why? Because you couldn't trust their word. They would never tell you something if it might hurt you. They'd say anything but. And you never, if you wanted to know, does this tie go with this suit? Don't ask this guy. He'll lie to you. You can't trust him. If it's anything negative, anything that might hurt you, he's not going to say it, because there was a culture in the yeshiva to regard other people's feelings and to be sensitive. That's what the yeshiva taught. That's how the yeshiva acted. I was once zochah to drive the yeshiva more than once, and two interesting stories. I'll do the first story first. We were in a bad neighborhood, and there were no GPSs in these days, and I was lost. Now, you have to appreciate, when you're with an Adam Gadol, and you're driving him somewhere, and you're dead lost, and you don't have a clue where you're going, and it's a very, very ethnically challenged neighborhood, you begin sweating a bit. But keep in mind, this was like the 80s in New York, when rolling down your window was a bit dangerous in certain neighborhoods, and I'm feeling the pressure. In any case, at a certain point, I rolled down the window, and it wasn't something I'm proud of today, and I suspect I wouldn't have done, won't do it again, but I said to someone there, "Hey, yo, how do I get to so-and-so street?" And I said it in a very gossip manner, at which point the guy goes, "Hey, you go there, go." Roll up the sleeve. Thank you. The Shiva started laughing. The Rosh Yeshiva should have ripped me to shreds. The chutzpah, you speak in front of an ungodly that way, you speak to another human being that way. "Hey, yo, howdy." Not a word, laughing. "Yo, howdy, yo." I'll share with you one more car event. This one is powerful. We were driving on the highway, and we got off to the service road, and there was a lot of traffic. And apparently the traffic was caused by an ambulance way up in the front. We're a few hundred yards away, but you could see the flashing lights of the ambulance. And the Rosh Yeshiva goes, "Oh, yeah, an ambulance. Oh, yeah, I hope no one's hurt." We're slowly creeping up. We get a little bit closer, and you could see that they're bringing a stretcher. "Oy vey, oy, a person, oy." And we'll go back to talking about what we're talking. We get a little bit closer, and you could see the forms. "Oy vey, oy, it's a woman. Oy vey, oy. The pain the Rosh Yeshiva felt for some person he never met, never will meet, being pulled into an ambulance is hard to describe. But that was the man. You see, it wasn't just saying the shmuz. The Rosh Yeshiva lived the mussar that he taught, and that was something that he gave over. It's very hard, very, very difficult to try to sum up who the man was. Emes. The man stood for Emes. That's legendary. Many, many a time, the yeshiva was in serious financial jeopardy. He wouldn't budge an iota if it wasn't 100% straight. Would you like to hear an illustration of that? A certain Rosh Yeshiva calls up a local politician, and he asks this local politician for permission to do something. And this local politician says, "You ask Rabbi Leibowitz. If Rabbi Leibowitz says it's okay, I'll sign on it." This Rosh Yeshiva asked this politician, "What do you mean?" And this politician said as follows, "I was a part of getting state funding for that yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva called me up that they had used some of the funding, but some of the funding wasn't used. He wanted to return it. In my entire career, no one has ever done that." By the way, that politician's name is David Patterson, the governor of New York State, just for the record. A check once bounced. Lots of checks bounce, except there was a matching check from a large foundation. You see, an employee had written a check to the yeshiva. The company matched it. The employee's check bounced. No one in the world would have known. The yeshiva returned that check to the foundation. It wasn't proper. And it was such an honesty, such an ethical approach. I can't tell you how many times I heard the yeshiva say, "Oy, don't ask me. Ask some other posek. You'll find a heter. Don't ask me." And the yeshiva felt bad. Guys would ask him shilas. And the yeshiva elder wasn't Yosha, but he felt bad. He wanted ask somebody else. Maybe you can find a heter. The yeshiva had such a sense of emes, but such a concern. He didn't want to burden anyone with it. But believe me, he rallied out when it wasn't personal. He rallied out with that sense of emes and how far a person has to go. The real godless of the yeshiva was his vision. I can't tell you how many times we sat there in Blotcher and the yeshiva would say, "We're taking over Long Island. We're taking over Long Island." We were in this beat up old building in Forest Hills. And the yeshiva felt we had to move. He wanted to move to Long Island. Why Long Island? Because there are 100,000 Jews. We'll build a campus there. We'll spread Torah. We'll be makar of the entire Long Island. The man had such a powerful sense of vision. "Give me three guys, I'll give you yeshiva. We got to change the face of this country." And he sent out Talmidim to the Arba Kanfos Aretz because his vision was so clear and so powerful. And he sent people out to all over America because he built within them that confidence, that understanding that they could, and that far-reaching vision. As a Talmud, it is very hard to describe my feelings and my regards to my Rebbe. I could describe maybe the tears that I shed when, as a grown person, I found out that the yeshiva was nifter. But it's very hard to regard the fact that the way you think, the way you approach life, your mahalach ha-chaim comes from this man. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Moshe Rabbeinu. You could be as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, literally. You could be the Av in Chochmah, in Nevuah. You could go up to Shemayim for 40 days and 40 nights, not eat and not drink, and you come back down and people could suspect you of stealing what? 16 shkolim, petty thievery, from the Mishkan when there's no need for the money. Why? Because when you live amongst great people, you don't perceive it that way. They're like me, a little bit better, a little bit more. Many a time I heard guys ask the yeshiva, "But Rebbe, you're no geya bedavar. It's your yeshiva, it's your vision." Because it's very difficult to appreciate the greatness of a person. When the Chofetz Chaim was alive, yeah, people knew about him, but not really who he was. No matter how much you understand a person is, unless you're separate from them, unless you step away, you never perceive their greatness. And I think as Talmidim of the Reshiva, it certainly was very, very true. It's only after the Petira that we begin reflecting back, we begin recognizing, we begin appreciating who he was, what he was. I can't close with a story, because there's no single story that encapsulates who the man was or describes him. But I want to close with one observation. At the age of 24 years old, the man was sickly and very, very ill. And when he went to out the shidduch with the Rebbetzin, the Rebbetzin's father understood who this person was. It was an Eloi. This man was Reb David's son. This man was Rosh Hashiva now for 6 years. Rosh Hashiva was 30 when he got married. And obviously, Reb Avram Trupp, who was himself a tremendous Talmud Chacham, recognized who this man was, and he was against the Shidduch. And you know why? Because everyone knew that the Rosh Hashiva would not live very long. He was too sickly. He was ill. And it was a bad Shidduch for his daughter because after a little while, he's going to leave her an almana. And Reb Avram Trupp was against the Shidduch. Ironically, the Rosh Hashiva outlived his Rebbetzin. We all knew the Rosh Hashiva was not going to live that long. He outlived the Rebbetzin. He married a second time. And if I would describe to you what it was like when the Rosh Hashiva came in and said the words, "I'm a chassan. I'm a chassan. Come to me, a mazel tov." The man was 89 years old. 89 years old, and the energy, the vibrancy, and he had to have a wedding, obviously. But it's a second wedding, certainly not a big celebration, right? All he wanted at his wedding was his family, his sons, meaning his Talmidim. And the entire yeshiva from Arba Kanfos Arts came in from California, from Rochester, from Milwaukee, from Eretz Yisrael. They came in and the yeshiva was packed because all he wanted at his wedding was his children. And that's all that came. And as he went to the chuppah, people heard him say, "My Talmidim, my sons come to be Masameach with me." But there was such a youth, such a vibrancy to the man. At 24 years of age, no one would have read it that way. At 24 years of age, he was orphaned. At 24, he was penniless. He was in a country that had so little regard for Torah learning that surely he should have been a doctor as he once aspired to be, and his father directed him not to. At 24, he took on this yoke of being the Rosh Hashiva of the leader, and he went through so much adversity, so many times being knocked down again. And keep in mind, Chafetz Chaim was not popular at all. It was a unique derech. It wasn't even accepted amongst the Talmid Chachamim of the generation. It was too special, too different. He had no money, no acceptance, no one regarded him. He was ill and sickly most of his life with migraines, headaches, neuromuscular disease, stomach ailments. He didn't have children. And yet the man has accomplished something that's hard to imagine. I asked Rabbi Harris Ashaila 2 days ago, what was Rabbi Harris's response? "The Rosh Hashiva always," and I finished the sentence. You see, what the Rosh Hashiva created was not just an empire, not just almost 100 institutions that teach his way, not just thousands of Talmidim. He created a way of thinking, a way of approaching life, a way of approaching the Gemara. And when you ask people what they think, I asked once a Rosh Hashiva the following question. We were discussing a certain issue, to do this, to do that, pros, cons, etc. So I said to him as follows, "What do you want to do?" So he said to me as follows, "I'll ask the Rosh Hashiva." I said, no, "What do you want to do?" He said, "I told you, I'll ask the Rosh Hashiva, and when the Rosh Hashiva tells me, then I'll know what I want to do." And he was serious. But my friends, he wasn't brainwashed. He wasn't a Lilliputian. He wasn't a small-minded man. He was a Talmud. And he's a great person. He's a leader. And now that his Rosh Hashiva, now that his Rebbe is no longer here, believe me, he makes fine decisions on his own. The Rosh Hashiva left an indelible imprint, a mahalach in thinking, a mahalach in machshava, a mahalach in life. This is the Masorah. This is the way it was done before. This is the way it was done the generation before that. This is the continuation of that Masorah. This is the way my Rebbe thinks. The more a person is aligned to Torah and the Das Torah, the more they understand life, the more they understand that they're doing correctly. What the Rosh Hashiva gave over to a generation was Das Torah, a link to Sinai, a link to previous generations, a way to approach everything in life. He lives with us today. May Hashem grant that we continue to be Mezaka the Rosh Hashiva, that the Rosh Hashiva should continue to teach us. Be us Mashiach Meher B'meinu.